Okay, I think the live stream is now operational as well on YouTube. So if you want to watch this later, if you could follow the Google the YouTube link, you could find us on YouTube, the Center for Foreign Policy and Peace Research, and watch the recording there as well. But okay, so always awkward at these introductions, but I'd like to welcome everyone to this talk by Dr. Barry Bouzan, entitled Two Approaches to Global IR, Civilizational and Humankind. This is part of our senior scholar series at the Center for Foreign Policy and Peace Research and our journal, All Azimuth, the Journal of Foreign Policy and Peace Research. We're always very interested in topics pertaining to the international relations discipline and also to the global IR discussion, which has been going on for many years now, generating a lot of interesting discussions about the discipline, the various, let's say, variations in the way that the discipline is being practiced, in the way that publications are made, and the voices being represented. And we're very thankful to Dr. Barry Bouzan for agreeing to join us to deliver this talk. I obviously don't need to say much about Dr. Bouzan, as all of you who are interested in international relations are well familiar with his work. Whether it's on the English School, whether it's on the Copenhagen School, or this global IR debate as well, a discussion as well, his works, I'm sure, are familiar to all of you. With that said, the ground, let's say, rules for this talk are that Dr. Bouzan will be speaking for about 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and after that we'll have a Q&A session, in which case you'll have the opportunity to ask Dr. Bouzan questions. I'll ask that you kindly keep your questions short and to the point and relevant to the discussion, and otherwise I think we don't have any other issues. Let me also say one last word. Dr. Asad Aydınlı is unable to join us today. He's traveling as part of a Fulbright event, so he asked me to step in. So I send his best regards as well. And with all that said, allow me to yield the floor to Dr. Bouzan. Sorry for this very long introduction. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, can everybody hear me okay? Is that a reasonable sound level from here? I hope so. Let me know if not. Okay, today I want to talk about how to develop international relations towards a more global IR form. This is something that comes out, I suppose, mainly of the work that Amitav Acharya and I did. We, in a book we published in 2019, looked at the making of global IR and looked forward to its unfolding more and more in that direction. So this talk is trying to push that particular agenda forward by exploring ways in which IR might, in a sense, reorient or possibly even remake itself in order better to fulfill the demands of being a properly global discipline. Now, we all know how international relations was founded at the peak of Western wealth and power, and therefore it reflects the Western view of the world. That's very well established. And then if you don't know that story, you can read it in Amitav's and my book. Ayşe Zarrakol has added in some interesting other observations along those lines, showing how the story, even where other civilizations are bought into this story, they tend to be bought in relation to the West. In other words, not in and of themselves, but in how they related to the West. And that's often a very distorting way of looking at things. Now, you might think that post-colonialism is obviously the way forward here, but I have reservations about that. In the book, Amitav and I certainly credited post-colonialism with opening the way towards a more global IR by its sustained and longstanding critique of Eurocentrism, which was very much to the point. It doesn't, however, seem to me that post-colonialism or decolonialism or whatever other variants there might be out there of that is the best way forward. For me, there's too much unhelpful political baggage attached to it, and it seeks to redivide the world, if you like, in another and quite political way. And I'm not sure that new divisions are what we need to make a global IR. So I'm going to use this talk to look at two other ways of approaching a more global IR. I'm not suggesting that these are the only ways, but they are different from what's on offer from post-colonialism, and I think more promising. But I would think that, wouldn't I? Because these are approaches that I'm taking, and I'm not noted as a post-colonialist. So these two approaches, one of them will be, I will label civilizational or possibly comparative civilizations. And here I'm going to look at two very current works, a follow-on book that I did with Amitav, and Aisha Zarikol's recent book on Before the West, which I think are exemplars of what this kind of approach looks like and what it can offer and what it can do. And then the second approach I'm going to look at is something that I'm working on myself at the moment. I'm writing a book in two versions at the moment. I'm not sure which, if either, will see the light of day or when, but this is taking an approach which I think of as a humankind approach. In other words, the starting question is, what does international relations look like if we approach it with the idea that the subject is humankind? Right? How does humankind organize itself? And how has that been patterned over the course of human history? So two different sorts of approaches, which do different kinds of things, but I think both offer the pathways forward towards a more global IR, and certainly both offer plenty of opportunities to pitch in and do complementary research. Okay, so let me start with the civilizational approaches. The basic idea here is, if the problem is that IR is too much centered on European and Western civilization, then we need to bring other histories, other civilizations into the study of the subject. So this means adding other sources of political theory from other cultures and also other histories of structure and practice from other cultures to see what international relations look like when it was done, as it were, outside and even beyond the West. And it's important that these stories be told, in a sense, apart from the Western story, not linked to it somehow, but putting the West in whatever its relevant context was at the time, which may have been, if we go back a few centuries, the West, Europe at any rate, was a very marginal, inconsequential sort of place for most of the rest of the world. And it's important to understand this and to reflect it in these studies. And that is what Aisha Zarikol does so well. So let me start by looking at her book briefly, and then at the one I did with Amitav, both of them published this year. So it doesn't get any more recent than that. Right? So Aisha's book, Before the West, is essentially a presentation and an outstanding one, I think, of the Mongol and then to some extent Islamic world order between the 13th and 16th centuries. And she looks at this as a world order. In other words, as a kind of civilization and society that had a concept of world order and practices that supported it, that were self-contained within it and had basically little relationship with the West, which was very marginal. Europe was very marginal and for the most part, fairly inconsequential to this system. Right? So she looks at it in its own terms, starting with the original Mongol Empire of Genghis Khan and then working her way through the historical sequence of that civilization. So the splintering of the original empire into the four Khanates and then the successor civilizations, the Timurid and Ming China ones, both of which took a lot of their political substance from this original Mongol form, and finally down to the Ottomans, the Safavids, and the Mughals, which take you up into the 17th and 18th centuries. So she charts the legacy of this order, even pushing it to give a sense of why, for example, Russia works in the way it does, and how Russia as a polity relates to this former form of civilization, if you will, and a form of world order. So she looks at this as a world order in the sense of something that had organized trade, it had organized diplomacy, it had a transnational culture, and it had a particular political style, which she argues derived from the original Mongol Empire, which she describes as a very highly concentrated form of sovereignty, where basically there is one man, it generally was a man, or possibly always in that set of examples, that had basically the power to do everything, right? So there wasn't any sharing of power with religions or anything like that. It was a highly concentrated form of sovereignty. And this worked in its own way. It was legitimized by its ability to conquer and to seek a kind of universal world order. And as long as the conquest went on, this legitimized the form of leadership. It was multicultural in the sense that ethnic and cultural and linguistic divides were not particularly important to the way that it ran. Instead, and it didn't run on states as such, it ran on what she describes as great houses, for which there is a hierarchy, so the sort of top great houses like the Chinggisid line itself, down to relatively minor local houses, all of which were arranged in a hierarchy. So that was the kind of, it wasn't a system of states, it was a system of great houses. And she nicely points to the Habsburgs as an interesting European equivalent of a great house, which is trying to organize a kind of universal empire. Right? So it's a very distinctive approach. It's not like the Western political order at all. And it really had very little to do with the Western political order, with which its contact was fairly marginal, and it had Europe and other such like was not a great center of wealth and power for most of this time, a bit more so towards the end, but for most of it, not. So this is a history that can be told handily apart from the Western one as a thing complete in itself and therefore available for comparison. She charts also the disintegration of this order, looking to find their possible lessons for an allegedly declining West and saying, you know, here's a kind of comparator that you can use that's a completely different kind of political order and you can look at it in that way. So this contribution, this way of doing global IR, is to bring in another world order, another civilization, its history, and its ideas, and show what kind of model of rise and decline it has, and what kind of structure it has, et cetera, et cetera. And all of this is brilliantly done and very clearly written. And if you're interested in this kind of thing, I can certainly recommend that book. Now, Amitav Acharya and I felt that in our 2019 book, we had kind of opened the path, in a sense, towards a global IR, and made the suggestion that more comparative civilization need to be brought into this, but we hadn't actually done it. I mean, we ran out of space in that book to do it, so we decided to move on and have a go at that. Now, obviously, that requires a rather wide range of knowledge, to put it mildly. So we restricted ourselves to looking at three civilizations and trying as best we could to disentangle them from whatever history they might have had with the West. So our driving question was different from Aisha's. We were thinking along the lines, well, the world we're moving to is one which we call deep pluralism, in which there's a widening diffusion of wealth and power and cultural and political authority. And therefore, we need to know the answer to the question of what are these cultures, what are these new players going to bring to the table of international relations? They're going to arrive there, indeed have already arrived there, but what kind of ideas, what kind of historical baggage and such like do they bring with them? And that was the question we were trying to answer. One justification for doing this was, of course, that only the West went through that particular period of modernity and global dominance. So we can't kind of think about what would have happened if those other civilizations had been in that position instead of the West. We don't go there. We don't try and do that. So we're more looking backwards and justifying this by the way in which Western IR also looks backwards and is still influenced by, you know, writers from a long time ago. They're influenced by the history and practice and literature of ancient Greece and classical Rome. So writers like Thucydides are still in play, and writers from hundreds of years ago like Hobbes and Machiavelli are still in play. In other words, the practice of the political thinking and the history from earlier times is still part of what it informs Western IR and what the West brings to the table. And therefore, it seems reasonable to assume that the same would be true for other cultures. And therefore, it's worth looking back at them in a comparative way to see, as it were, what kind of ideas, what kind of practices might inform their view of international relations. So we know that a lot of these cultures are bringing post-colonial resentment to the table, fair enough, but what's their own legacy of history and practice that they're also bringing to the table here? Now, to try and get at that, we looked at six areas of comparison so that we could take six what we hope are broadly neutral concepts and ideas that seem to play a role in the theory and practice of all of these civilizations. Once you begin to familiarize yourself with some of their early literature, these kinds of discussions pop up. So these six perspectives, as it were, are set up as a kind of model that could be applied not just to the three civilizations we look at, namely pre-Mughal India, China, and the Islamic world. They could be a model to be applied to any other civilization as well, and its literature and practices, to see if that still fits. So the six factors we looked at were, first of all, power politics. We had no difficulty at all finding reference for discussion and practice of power politics in all of these civilizations. All of them also had discussions and practices around hierarchical orders. Interestingly, all of them had a reference around peaceful coexistence. We tend to think of pre-modern times as fairly violent and imperial competitions and wars, et cetera, but there was an element of peaceful coexistence here. And it's interesting that in this sense, peaceful coexistence was often talked about in the context of empire. In other words, the principal model across these civilizations for peaceful coexistence was the successful implementation of a universal empire. That would be what brought peace. All of them also had discussions and practices around trade, therefore a kind of international political economy variable, if you like. There were also common discussions and practices around the differentiation between territorializing approaches and what these days we would call transnational approaches, and the kinds of actors that that go with that. And all of them also had some concern, as does contemporary IR, with modes of thinking. So you can find relationalist strands and rationalist strands and types of dialectics in many of these civilizations. So there seemed to be a sufficient basis to go ahead with a comparative study that didn't presuppose a set of Western concepts. Now, you might argue that this is a set of Western concepts, so that's something that we might talk about in the discussion, but it doesn't seem to be. I mean, these concepts seem to be fairly universal, and the West is just one and the most recent reflection of them. So in that sense, the West could be also analyzed under this this set of ideas. So what we found was that there was really no tremendously stark differentiation. In other words, we couldn't say one of these civilizations was this way and another one was that way, and that you know, they were very obviously different in a clear way. They were more mixtures, in the sense of that in all of them, versions and variants of these concepts could be found. All of them, for example, had this idea of a successful universal empire as the leading form of peace project. All of them also seemed to share some kind of version of the mandate of heaven, where the legitimacy of rulers was somehow validated in a religious way by linkages of one sort or another to gods of one sort or another. We found a bit of a spectrum in a sense that China seemed to lean more strongly and more consistently towards the universal empire, and therefore, in a sense, statist and territorial mode of international relations, whereas Europe, of course, infamously leans, at least in recent centuries, it leans more towards the idea of an anarchic state system and a decentralization of power. And that contrast is interesting because it seems to be to reflect, I suppose, is the right word. It seems to reflect a different evolution of political understanding in those civilizations, where for the Chinese, the idea of hierarchy is the key ordering principle politically and socially. Whereas in the West, the key ordering principle has eventually become the kind of distribution of power in both internationally and domestically, so that one has balancing forces to constrain the exercise of centralized power. And that has become, in a sense, the preferred principle of order. So from a Western perspective, too much hierarchy is a form of disorder. From a Chinese perspective, too much pluralism is a form of disorder. And that reflects quite, therefore, deep philosophical differences in the deep background of these civilizations. If China and Europe constitute the ends of a spectrum, the middle seems to be occupied by India and the Islamic world, both of which are interesting examples of kind of hybrid systems, that they have quite a lot of what in English school terms would be called world society. So the idea of, say, of an Islamic community, or in the case of India, more the idea of religious communities, Buddhism, for example, and Hinduism as transnational activities that are not particularly linked to the state. And in both cases, these transnational dimensions of these civilizations actually do quite a lot to not replace, but to minimize the need for stronger political structures, so that in both the Islamic world and in the Hindu world with the caste system, the kind of basic rules of society and also the basic rules for the economy are bound up in the culture itself. It doesn't, in a sense, require a state or an empire to do these things. So these civilizations have been one in which the political structures have had shallower roots and have been more transitory. So this is the kind of comparison that we've got going and which we think provides interesting insights into what these cultures, in the light of their own historical backgrounds and practices and thinking, what they will bring to the table. One caveat on all of that is that fairly consistently there has been a contradiction within these societies between the aspiration to universal claims. The Chinese idea of all under heaven is perhaps the clearest statement of this, and the pluralist realities. So this was also present in the Islamic world, where according to the theology, there's only supposed to be one Islamic state. But for most of history, there have been more than one Islamic state, and therefore they've had to have international relations. They've had to either get on or not get on with each other, to fight each other or to cooperate. And of course, like everybody else, they did a bit of both. But it does put that contradiction into the heart of it. And that's something that Aisha also identifies in her book, that the Chinggisid political form worked as long as you could make the case that it was expanding and therefore might validate itself by reaching a universal empire, it was okay. But as soon as it ran out of steam, which of course all of them did, because they simply didn't have the logistics and the technology and the numbers to construct a real universal empire, then this undermined, this contradiction undermined the legitimacy of the system. Okay, so that's the kind of civilizational approaches, and obviously that opens up a huge agenda of things to do. There's lots of other civilizations that can be looked at using either Aisha Zarikal's approach or the approach that Amitav and I have used, or indeed some other approach which you are free to invent for yourselves. But the basic idea is to pursue the logic of comparative civilizations and try to bring that into thinking about and indeed practicing international relations. Okay, so that takes me to the rather vaguer terrain of what I'm trying to do at the moment, which I'm calling the global society approach. It's for those of you who've been following what I do, it will not surprise you that there's a strongish English school element here, although whether everybody in the English school would recognize themselves in what I'm doing is perhaps an interesting question, which will be answered in due course. But the starting point here is to focus not on civilizations as the object of study and the comparison of them, but on humankind as the object of study, right? So the animating question for me, perhaps coming out of English school thinking about world society and such like, the animating question for me is, what do we see? How would one interpret and view international relations, and what kind of theoretical approach would one have to it if the basic understanding of the subject was that the object of study is humankind? How does humankind organize itself? How does that work? In other words, it's a jump up in the level of generalization of the approach, but it's also quite a significant reorientation of the focus of the field, and in that sense might be quite radical, perhaps impossibly so. We'll just have to wait and see on that. So then the question becomes, what do we share, right? What do we all share as humankind? What can we look at to try and understand ourselves on that level? Now, if we look at states or civilizations or things like that, or religions, we're looking at what divides us up, right? And how those parts get along or don't. But what do we share as a whole? What can we see in terms of a structural approach that would enable us to think about ourselves as a species? The approach I take says there are basically three things here to look at. One is, what are the planetary conditions in which our civilizations and we as a species as a whole, what planetary conditions are there for this? And what are the material conditions? What kind of resources do we have access to that we know about and can get? What kinds of energy sources do we have? What kinds of technologies can we make out of those two things? And then the third one is, what's the social structure? And I'll say a bit much more about that in a minute, because that's where I'm building more specifically on English school approaches. Another way of looking at this is to think about a quote, not sure whether it's a precise quote, but it's often cited as such, from Marx, where he says, people make their own history, but not in the circumstances of their own choosing. Now, vast amounts have been written about people making their own history. That's what world historians and global historians do. That's the basic definition of their subject. But not so much has been written about the circumstances in which all of that is done. And so the focus of what I'm trying to do is to bring out the circumstances which we share. These things are all happening in a similar set of conditions. So the aim here is somehow to fill in the space between English school type approaches in IR, global historians, and global historical sociologists, who tend to favor very, like Marx and Wallerstein and others, tend to favor very big, one size fits all grand explanations for everything. I'm trying to do something in between that level, that very high level of generalization, and the more detailed narrative of the historians. So I want a fairly detailed but still structural look, which can be presented in narrative terms. So let me say a little bit about the English school approach here, because it basically builds on an expanded idea of what I call in the English school primary institutions, those organizing ideas around which international and indeed global society are built. You're probably all familiar with the classical English school set, Headley Bull and all that. So the kind of sovereignty, territoriality, making up the state, and then international law and war and balance of power and great power management and that kind of stuff is the traditional, very Westphalian focused set of things. I've set about expanding this quite considerably, partly because one of the insights, revelations, what have you, that I've had along the way to doing this work is that it's a mistake to think of the institutions of international society as basically interstate things, right? For me, as I think more and more about this, these institutions work across not just interstate or interpolity society, but also transnationally. Think of the way the market and sport work transnationally, and into the interhuman domain, the domain of that I think of as being about the patterns of identity, like religion and nationalism and such like. So if you want to think of nationalism as an institution of international society, as James Mayall proposed, a very good idea, I think, immediately you can see that that is not confined to the interstate domain. It's deeply embedded in the interhuman domain as well. The market and sport are more in the transnational domain. Things like science and development are spread across these domains. Almost everything works across these three domains. So that's why I'm thinking of this as global society. Right? And when you start to think in that way, then the range of possible things that might count as an institution becomes clearer and wider. So it includes things like development, like environmental stewardship, the market, the question of human equality or inequality, which is a master institution containing lots of things like slavery and dynasticism and patriarchy and inequalities of wealth, et cetera, and science and sport. Now, you may be thinking, what have science and sport got to do with any of this? Well, the path I'm following here is one that I developed with Robert Faulkner when we were trying to answer the question, which we did in an article a few years ago, on when can we say or can we say that environmental stewardship became an institution of international society? Now, we developed there an empirical approach to this, basically saying that it had to tick a number of boxes before you could say it had actually arrived as being an institution of international society. And you could track this. You could look at the way in which a new norm was generated and then spread. So, you know, there's plenty of literature that looks at how the idea of sovereignty or how the idea of the market or environmental stewardship, how these ideas grew up from something and then spread and became more global. You looked for secondary institutions. Have these ideas generated intergovernmental organizations or regimes or anything of that sort? So if you think of the market as an institution, you know, it's everything from the World Trade Organization on down, there's dozens and dozens of things. If you think of sport, I mean, most of you are probably football fans, you know, and you probably have a much clearer map in your minds than I do of how many organizations there are and global federations and all of that stuff that represent the organization of sport. You look at the state adaptations to these things. How do states change their institutional structures? How do they change their law? How do they change their behavior in response to these new norms? They set up ministries of the environment. They might set up ministries of sport and other kinds of things. So you can track the way in which these things become embedded in the state structures themselves. And you can also look at the way in which institutions interact, you know, how do rising institutions interact with the institutions that are already there. James Mayall, again, pioneered this by looking at the way that the rise of nationalism affected other institutions like territoriality and sovereignty and such like. And you can see in the case of environmental stewardship, one of the big impacts there has been to shift what was the existing institution of development, of the kind of right to development, to the right to sustainable development, right? So you can see that that these institutions are interacting. So that's the basic framing for thinking about global society in terms of a more or less English school concept of institutions. Now, working that way with the three factors of planetary, material, and social conditions, with this set of primary institutions being the central content of social conditions. What I then did was to apply this to the question of identifying eras in human history, starting from the last ice age. And somewhat to my astonishment, this came out very clearly in the sense you could identify a very clear kind of hunter-gatherer era that went up to about 10,000 BC, in which the planetary conditions and the material conditions and the social structures were relatively the same across humankind. You then get a period of transition. So I introduce here a somewhat novel idea in terms of human eras, that there are eras, but they are separated by periods of transition. And that the first one of these is between about 10,000 BC and 4,000 BC, and is marked by a change in the planetary conditions, where you get global warming leading to a stable, reasonably warm climate, the so-called Holocene era. And that produces, first of all, a shift from mobile lifestyles to settled ones, and then a shift to agrarian production rather than hunter-gathering. So you've got a longish transition there. Then you get a second era. I like to think of this as the empire of eras and human inequality, which goes from around 3000 BC to 1800 AD. That era is fairly well established in the idea of agrarian empires and such like. It is probably familiar to most of you. But I then depart from the norm by saying where we've been since the beginning of the 19th century is in a second transition period, which has not finished yet. We're still in a transition period. We don't know what era three looks like. We don't know what modernity looks like, and that's a long and complicated story that I don't have time to tell here. So it seems to me that where we are now is kind of hitting the limits again of planetary carrying capacity. So we're in another crisis as to whether the kind of untrammeled, unrestrained pursuit of wealth and power that's been going on for the last two centuries, how does this square, can it be squared with the clear limitations on planetary carrying capacity that we are meeting now? So that's in a sense the dilemma that we're in. But all of this works, or at least I think it works, at the level of humankind, right? So one can have a coherent discussion about the organization of our species and how that organization has evolved in terms of what are its characteristic social structures, what are its characteristic material structures, and what are the planetary conditions that either support or undermine it. And that gives you a way, as it were, of taking this discussion about global IR up to a different level, a higher level, unfamiliar terrain in some respects, but perfectly doable. I can assure you, and quite a lot of fun. I've had a good time writing this book. Okay, well, I can see that my allocated time is running out. So let me just draw some conclusions from this. I think these two approaches, the civilizational one and, if you like, the global society or the humankind one, they're not mutually exclusive. Right? I'm not trying to set these up as one is better than the other, or we should go one way and not the other. I think we should do both. They require different kinds of expertise. They make different kinds of contributions. And there's huge scope in both to redefine IR in a more global direction by making it, in a sense, more representative of humankind, either by bringing in more civilizations one by one or in groups, or just pushing the whole level of analysis up to the point of humankind. I think, as I mentioned in the beginning, that the kind of post-colonial approaches and what is now a little family of approaches there, that doesn't seem to me to be the best way forward. This remark will probably make me unpopular in some quarters, but I think divisive politicization, which is what is largely on offer in that approach, is not what we need now. It is, I would grant, it is one way forward into a more global IR. I would not deny it that. But I don't think it's what we need at the moment, and I don't prefer it as an approach. We do need a more truly global IR because we need to deal with the planetary and species survival issues, the various shared fates from pandemics to climate change that are now in front of us and that are not going away. And these things are now in front of us at a time when our capacity to manage the planet and ourselves as a species is, if not quite at an all-time low, then at least at a relative low, because we are also in the transition period between the kind of first burst of the transition moving towards modernity, which was marked by an extremely uneven distribution of wealth, power, and cultural and political authority. That's now breaking down, and we're moving into a second phase in which wealth, power, and cultural and political authority are more diffused in the system. The rise of China is the marker for that, but there are plenty of others. So with this going on, there is a quite considerable problem about how we manage ourselves as a species and how we manage the crisis we're in. We need to do this not just in academia, but also in the real world. And we need to do it fairly soon. And I think the idea that we start trying to think about international relations from this higher point of view, this big picture point of view, if you will, although it will take many of you out of your disciplinary comfort zones, it's worth doing. And anyway, that's what I'm doing. And we'll see whether it works or not. Okay, thank you for listening.
Professor Razan, thank you very much for the talk. Now, I'm going to yield to the floor. I'd like all of you to, contribute, obviously. I'm just going to take three questions at a time. And Dr. Bozan will answer them, and then we'll have three more sets. We'll just keep going that way. I just have a couple of questions, but I'm going to restrain myself, English school sense of restraint. I'll maybe get to that much later if we have time for it. So with that said, I think I saw, Dr. Shebnam Udun, I believe. I think you had your hand up. Would you like to speak up first?
Actually, it was an applause, not for a question.
My apologies, my apologies. Well, let me, in that case, okay, let me, if people are asking questions, I'm unable to see them here. So let me, in that case, oh, is that an applause or a hands up question? In that case, let me ask first. Now, I'll have to be honest with you. I haven't, okay. Mehmet Çelebi, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, I was thinking about my question, I was trying to formulate it, but seeing that nobody is jumping up, I tried to jump up. My question is about using civilizations as a unit of analysis, I guess. I mean, maybe I'm wary of the concept because of Huntington, and it brings up images of clash of civilizations. But still, basically, my question is whether civilizations are isolated enough or homogeneous enough to be used as units of analysis. Thank you.
Okay, that's our first question. Thank you. And Ismail Yaylıcı, if I may, please go ahead. You're still mute.
Thank you for this great talk. And thank you for the opportunity and for the invitation. One thing, I was able to read the introductory chapter of your 2019 book, with Amitabh Acharya, and there you suggest that you know, when you talk about the reasons why studying the civilizational repertoire or the different historical repertoire of different civilizations, is one of the reasons is that it provides a window into different repertoires, different it gives hints about theory and method. But you also suggest that it facilitates our understanding of the current behavior of rising powers like India, China, and Iran and Turkey. And my question was really about the second part. Of course, we all realize that, especially in today's world, we see the rising assertiveness of different civilizational basins. But to what extent do you think this really informs actual foreign policy behavior on the ground? I'm reminded of things like, one scholar wrote about Ayatollah Machiavelli, for example, that the Ayatollahs of Iran are very much on a Machiavellian trend, and that the vocabulary that, say, realism provides is enough to understand what Iran's foreign policy behavior. Or even think of John Mearsheimer saying that he feels more at home in China than in the United States because of the way people think about foreign policy actions. So to what extent you think it, or say, for example, Islamic concepts of Ummah or the Caliphate or even more recent conceptions, you know, people often say that these do not inform foreign policy behavior, but rather these are broader cultural concepts that that lurk in the background. So my question is, to what extent do you think this informs actual foreign policy behavior? Thank you.
In fact, if I may also add one more, just piggyback on that, it seems to me that a lot of the decision making that takes place within states are informed by institutions and a general, I would say, a global culture as well. Do these not have a much stronger impact on the decision making than, say, you know, outstanding cultural values or maybe historical ideas? I suppose you could even get into the literature on strategic culture as well in this case. But Professor Bozan, please go ahead. I just want to add that, but thank you.
Okay, thank you for those questions. I think, yeah, I absolutely agree that it's a valid criticism of Huntington to have, in a sense, not dealt well enough with the idea that civilizations aren't actors. Okay? So in his book, he rather assumes without saying so that civilizations have actor quality. And I think that it's a reasonable critique of them that, you know, unless they happen to be for some specific time and place represented by an empire. They are not the actors themselves, but they are the place that you go to look for ideas and thinking, which will be, so you can think of a kind of Confucian zone of thinking, or earlier on you could think of a kind of Hindu zone of thinking, or nowadays you can perhaps think of an Islamic zone of thinking about international relations and politics, and that these things matter. They have deep roots. I mean, I made the point, and I'll reiterate it again, that if you look at the way Western IR works, not just as theory, but also as practice, then old stuff and old analogies matter. I mean, think back to your undergraduate days of being taught international relations and dragged through Thucydides and all that kind of stuff, as if this still meant something. Now, look at the literature, look at the amount of books written about Thucydides and ancient Greece and the wars between Rome and Carthage and all of that. That stuff is still thought about. It still very much affects, certainly in academia, and since academia in an indirect way affects how policymakers think, because they've all gone to university for the most part. And so these things diffuse, it seems to me, and they are important points of reference. Realism, for example, justifies itself by the timelessness of and the fact that it can actually project, says it can project its theory and ideas, all the way back to the beginning of recorded history and validate it that way. It's always been the same. It's the same dynamic, blah, 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 blah. The labels may change on who the actors are, but the basic business is the same. I think that it does matter in that sense. It's a resource that we need to look at. And there are differences. I mean, I'm quite, for example, impressed by the literature that at the moment looks at China, trying to understand what's going on in China and why China behaves the way it does and why it's structuring itself the way it does. And in my mind, China's a bit of a hobby of mine, and so I know a bit about it, but there's a fairly extensive literature which I agree with, which sees that, in a sense, the Communist Party ruling China is steadily taking on something very much like the form of a traditional Chinese empire, right? So it is increasingly looking towards having an emperor, the one person in whom power and authority are notionally concentrated. It's obsessed with holding itself together as an empire and preventing any kind of drifting away of provinces or anything like that. It's obsessed with unity and with central control over things. Its foreign policy agenda at the moment doesn't look very different from that of a traditional Chinese empire. It's mainly Asia-centered. It's very inward-looking. And this is the Communist Party running the show. I mean, hello. It's not supposed to look like that, but it does. Right? So it seems to me that these things are still very active. If you look in India, I mean, what's the governing ideology of India at the moment? Hindutva, right? So that look back into civilizations is being used to justify a load of policies, whether you like them or not. But the referent is a civilizational referent, and it's looking back into a deep past and finding that important in shaping and justifying behaviors in the present. So I don't have any difficulty with this idea. I'm not saying if you understand the past of a civilization, you understand all of its present day behavior. Right? So in the recent book with Amitav, you will find a long and somewhat agonized discussion about how can you talk about this? Because at the end of the day, all of these other civilizations have had their big encounter with Western civilization, and they all lost and were done down and went through their own versions of the century of humiliation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're all quite rightly resentful about that and not letting it go. Right? So that experience, okay, is something which you can't dissociate from the West, and you can't kind of do a counterfactual account and say, well, you know, if it had been, I don't know, China rather than Europe that dominated the world, what would that have done to China? What would it have looked like? I mean, there's just, you could write some interesting, you know, counterfactual fiction on that basis, but I don't think you can make any kind of hard and fast projection of what that would look like. So it's not an attempt to say this explains everything. It's basically saying you need to understand the background of these other civilizations as they are coming to the table, and the actors that think that they represent those civilizations, because that stuff is still in play. It's not the only thing in play, but it does provide a set of metaphors and analogies and theories that will inform the way that people think. And it also provides a resource, you know, a comparative IR resource. What do other systems look like? How do they operate? Even though they may have been at a different stage of technological development and such like from ourselves, there's clearly quite a lot, in those six basic ideas that I set out, that Amitav and I use for the comparison. You know, that works. It works across time and space. Not difficult to find, referent behaviors and referent discussions of those things across all of those civilizations. So, with the caveat that this is, doesn't tell you everything you need to know. It simply tells you some important things that you need to know, which are part of the package. That I will stick with.
Thank you very much. Memeto-chan, did you have a follow-up? You still have your hand up.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Okay. All right. Who else? Well, please feel free to raise your hands. Let's have another round of questions. Okay, Shebna Hojang, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Now, this one is for a real question. It is great to see Professor Buzan, and thank you again for this talk. My question is about, as you said, the foreign policy behavior, which is affected by basically the sociology of things. And I would like to know if you had any research on the psychology that affected the foreign policy behavior and also the formation of civilizations. And to be direct, perhaps I should mention the concept of chosen trauma and chosen victory. This is one of the things that I also look at in my own research for understanding foreign policy behavior. And I wondered if you looked at the role of these chosen traumas in the formation of foreign policy behavior. Thank you.
Anyone else? I also have a question then. It was because obviously this is about global IR as well. And I was just wondering what you talk about this as obviously an instance of contributing to the global IR discussion by studying civilizations, using English school concepts to think about different way that, let's say, conceptions of world order have emerged. You've looked at this comparatively as well. But what are some gaps in this literature? What, for example, could aspiring researchers or people who are coming into this global AI discussion now and who want to contribute to it, what might they be interested in developing? What are some gaps that you thought about? What could be a neat idea that requires maybe, let's say, further scrutiny? Because we always talk about the need to have a more positive global AI agenda, because a lot of the studies out there are very political or very much centered on criticism. In fact, one of the publications that I contributed to as well, that I co-authored, also has that sort of stint as well. We want to develop a more positive agenda. So what would be your advice for, let's say, people who want to contribute to the global AI debate?
Okay, do you want me to answer those now? Or?
Yes, please, go ahead.
Okay. Well, the psychology of policy formation, the basic answer to that question is, I'm afraid, no. I've not done anything of this sort, and somewhat beyond my intellectual resources to do that sort of thing. So that, in a sense, leads into the answer to your question about, you know, where to from here. What are the kinds of work? Amitav and I wrote that book. It's quite a short book. I'm quite proud of that. It's the only short book I've ever written. It has been an aspiration of mine for some time, but I've mainly failed at it. But we were very conscious of the limits of our knowledge, right? So, I mean, writing up, you know, three civilizations in a chapter each, it's got to be at a fairly high level of generalization. And we saw that book as basically a door opening exercise. I mean, saying to people, you know, look, we know something about these three civilizations, and we think we know enough to stick our necks out in a kind of preliminary reconnaissance into what it might look like if you went there and how you might approach this kind of study. But the thrust of the book was very much that, you know, we're not experts in any of these civilizations. We are kind of hobbyists and amateurs in a sense. We kind of know what we're doing in a general way, but we have no kind of massive depth or detailed knowledge of this. So we focused on setting up a framework which people who knew more about these things than we do could retrace those steps if they wanted to, or redesign the framework if they felt that it was wrong in some ways, and do any number of things. I mean, there's all kinds of other civilizations, however you want to define that, that could be looked at in that framing. And the three that we looked at, I mean, that exercise hardly exhausts the topic. Right? So one might want to do, if one were qualified to do that and knew the literature well, one might want to do psychological studies. I'm not quite sure how that would be done. It's kind of pretty much outside my comfort zone. So I don't know how you could do psychological studies of dead people long ago, or maybe there's a, you know, an established methodology for that. I just don't know. But somebody who does know and found that interesting might want to pursue that and look into the thing from that particular angle. So I think there's a kind of infinity of possibilities, both in the three civilizations we looked at and also in the one that Aisha has looked at. I don't think, I don't know whether I can speak for her on this, but I don't get the impression that she thought that what she was doing was the last word on the subject, but that she was also opening up, saying, you know, hey, here, look, you know, there's something that's been pretty much neglected in IR literature, but which is actually pretty relevant to it. And so, you know, here's an overview. There's any amount of scope for those of you who prefer more detailed kinds of work to look into particular aspects of that and see whether her general take on it then holds up when you look at it in more depth and detail, and ditto for whether Amitav's and my take on the ones we looked at holds up. So it depends what you're interested in and what your expertise is. But I think this this approach certainly opens up a vast amount of vast agenda, if you will, of things that that people could do. I mean, look how ridiculously detailed a lot of the literature is on, you know, the balance of power and all of that. There's a lot of scope for this for anybody who wants to do it, either in the way that Aisha has done it, which is to say, looking at these things as completely separate from the West and looking at their own, you know, internal dynamics, or in the more general way that that Amitav and I have done it. I mean, I'm sure there are other ways of doing it as well. So it's a door opening exercise. So we're, you know, the thing will have been a failure if nobody follows it up, basically.
Thank you, Professor. Would anyone like to respond to that? Anyone? Are there any other questions? Ayrio Hocam, please.
Thank you for the opportunity of asking a question to Uzan. While you compare Western and Chinese world order, you said the Chinese understanding of world order is hierarchy. My question is, given the fact that we classify states as failed, rogue states, middle-range states, great powers, superpowers, or use some concepts like standard of civilization, which refer to some kind of leadership. What is the difference between the idea of declared hierarchy, as in the case of China, and implied hierarchy in the case of Western international system, or as you wish, international society, according to you? Thank you.
No. I couldn't hear that very well. It came across very echoey. Could you say that again a bit closer to your mic?
Sure, do you want me to repeat my question?
Yeah, but closer to the mic, because otherwise it's so echoey, I can't quite understand what you're saying.
Okay. I said that while you're comparing the Western and Chinese world order, you said that Chinese world, Chinese understanding of order is hierarchy.
Yeah.
And my question is, given the fact that we classify states as failed, rogue states, middle range powers, great powers, or superpowers, or the concepts like standard of civilization, referring to some kind of leadership, what is the difference between the idea of declared hierarchy, as in the case of, let's say, China, and implied hierarchy in the case of Western international system, or if you wish, international society?
Okay, you're asking me about two different types of hierarchy. Say the two types again. What's the word before hierarchy? Something hierarchy and then some other kind of hierarchy. What were they?
Yes, failed states, rogue states, I mean, great powers, superpowers, standard of civilization, developed states, or undeveloped or underdevelopment. These are all refers to an implied kind of hierarchy, according to me. Agree with me.
Yeah. Okay. So
declared and implied hierarchy, right? That if that's the part you didn't hear.
Okay. Yes. Declared and implied. Okay. And the question about that is.
Yes.
The difference between declared and implied.
Visualize with my own words as. In the Chinese case, there is a declared hierarchy, while in Western case, there is an implied hierarchy. Do you see, according to you, what is the difference between these two hierarchies?
Okay. Okay, I understand the question now. Shall I answer that one?
Please, go ahead.
Yeah. I see what you're getting at. I'm thinking off the top of my head here. I see what you're getting at with the idea of declared in the Chinese sense of, you know, the Middle Kingdom and a very explicit hierarchical order. Whereas in the, you know, the so-called Westphalian system, people are supposed to be equal, but nonetheless there are hierarchies. I haven't thought this through, but my first response is that there are an awful lot of declared hierarchies in the Westphalian practice as well, right? And there always have been, right? So sovereign equality, in a sense, implies to a certain band of things that are kind of like political status in some ways, and particularly legal status. But it doesn't necessarily apply to a lot else. So, I mean, even back in the early days, if we're back in Westphalian days, right, like in the 17th century, there was a hierarchy of ruling houses, right? So some, you know, emperors were higher than kings, were higher than princes, were higher than and all the way down. So, and that was very explicit in diplomacy, right? So those two, the declared, as it were, has always been, a declared hierarchy has always accompanied any notions of equality. In more recent times, in the 20th century, 19th and 20th century, that was very explicitly done for great powers, right? So in a whole variety, the Concert of Europe and such like, a whole variety of states were acknowledged as great powers and given particular rights and responsibilities on that basis. You know, that kind of takes you into the Headley Bull story and great powers and great power management and all of that. During the kind of heyday of Western empires, of course, there were all kinds of hierarchies there, and there was no, I mean, there the hierarchies were declared, right? If you were a colony, you were subordinate in a variety of ways, and that was all pretty clearly spelled out, and there wasn't much pretense at equality. During the imperial days, that inequality was often backed up by racism as well, in the sense that racism operated internationally to demean peoples, and that's why the Japanese got so upset about it in 1919. So I don't know, I think of all of those things as being declared. A developing country is a status acknowledged by the United Nations. To my amazement, the Chinese still cling onto this, so does India. They do not want to let go their formal status as developing countries because it has some advantages to them to have that status. So that's declared, it's formal, it's kind of applied for and formally recognized. Failed states is, of course, something that it's a label that states that think of themselves as not failed pin on to those that they think have fallen apart. And I agree that that does create a kind of hierarchy, but I don't think it's an implied hierarchy. I mean, it's a very implicit, a very explicit hierarchy in the sense that if you're a failed state, you can become in varying degrees, a ward of international society. You know, the IMF and the World Bank move in and run your economy. Some UN peacekeeping forces move in to try to keep political order, blah, 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 blah. There's not much implied about that. Right? It's all written down and sanctified in various ways. So I would say that there's always a mixture of hierarchy, or the tendency would be for there to be a mixture of hierarchy and equality But hierarchy is the more general form and equality the rarer one. And such equality as we have constructed over the last couple of centuries is still fairly narrowly cast. I mean, there's a human rights component to it, which works against racism. There's a development component to it that works against economic inequality. But these hierarchies are all still there, and they're pretty formal. And I mean, even the Chinese dealt to some extent with very distant powers like Russia in the early days. The Chinese dealt with the Russians more or less as equals, even though they would still retain the kind of verbiage of it being a tribute type hierarchical relationship. But in practice, it was quite pragmatic. So I guess I'm not seeing a big tension or a big contradiction between what you said was declared and implied hierarchy. I think most forms of hierarchy are pretty explicit.
Thank you, Professor. Otono-jam, you have your hand up. Please go ahead. Your microphone is off. Hang on.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much. My question is not really endogenous to the conference, which I appreciated very much. So I would like to thank very much, I mean, Professor. It is linked, my comment, to Dr. Shebnem Udum's question on the impact of psychology to international relations. I think it's extremely important, especially in considering the contemporary international relations and decision-making, the psychological impact of the decision-makers, especially at the top level, becomes really extremely important, a very important explanatory factor of the dynamics of the, I think, decision-making and of indirectly IR. So would it be possible, I mean, please, to make some comments on this issue?
I'm basically the wrong person to ask that question. I do have a well-known psychologist in my family tree, as it were, but probably not the kind of psychologist that you're thinking about. So B.F. Skinner was my father-in-law, and I know something about his theories, but basically you need to talk to somebody else about this. I just don't know, right? My whole approach to this subject has always been top-down, big picture, structural. That's what I do. That's what I have some talent for, and that's what I enjoy doing. I am noticeably poor at the street level of things, all right? How people interact with each other, the psychological issues, blah, 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 blah. I have never engaged with that. There is no doubt a literature on it, which I don't know. I don't know whether it's a big literature or a small one, whether it's any good or not, whether it's had much impact or not. I think the only brush with it I would have had would have been, you know, Robert Jervis and his Perception and Misperception, which was kind of required reading in my day, but nobody seemed to follow that up at all well. So I don't deny in the slightest that this might be a very interesting way of doing it. I would challenge you to say, why is this a good approach to global IR as opposed to other approaches? I mean, what do you see its contribution to global IR as being? I'm not immediately clear about how that would work unless you were seeing this in the context of comparative civilizations, i.e. if you're saying different civilizations have different psychologies, which might be a defensible position. I'm not sure. I just don't know enough about this. I've never thought my way through it and have not read the literature. But it could well be an interesting thing to do if it can be done. I don't know how you do psychoanalysis of dead people. I don't know what kind of resources are acceptable for undertaking a psychological analysis. I mean, how much and what kind of information do you need about somebody to do that kind of analysis? I just don't know. So I can't. All I can do is throw that question back at you. I'm sufficiently ignorant that I don't have anything else to suggest.
Thank you, Professor Bozan. I apologize. In my comment and question, I mentioned referring to contemporary decision-making and international relations. Ah. So for this reason, I said at the very beginning, my question, with my apologies, is exogenous to your conference.
Okay.
I wanted...
Perhaps,
in this sense, Shebnem Udum's, I think, question was extremely interesting.
Yeah, I think I don't know whether you know the work of Yan Shui Tong or not from Tsinghua University in China. Mm-hmm. He's got very interested of late in the issue of leadership and the quality of leadership as a comparative issue. That might at the moment be as close as you can get to the sort of thing you're looking for. It would be an interesting starting point for you, even if you disagreed with it or didn't think that it was doing what you wanted to do. But it has at least opened the door into looking at the quality of leadership in terms of the individuals who are leading and what kind of difference they make. So that's the only thing that I know of that might link to the sorts of interest you have.
Well, I don't know, how can we understand the Second World War without really understanding the psychology of Hitler or Mussolini or others, or how historically we can, I don't know, understand, I mean, some behavior and decision-making without understanding the decision-making of the people that they did. I mean, the leaders, I don't know, the kings or even emperors. I don't know. I
apologize. Well, you're no doubt right that you couldn't get a complete understanding of anything like that without having at least some element of that, but you will find plenty of people who are prepared to argue that you can make very good explanations for things like the Second World War that don't require particular leaders to be responsible for it. In other words, if Hitler hadn't been there, probably somebody else would have been there because the structure was all set up for that kind of thing to happen. So there's plenty of other, or balance of power theories, there are all kinds of ways of explaining things that don't require individual psychology. So you need to make the case for why you think the individual psychology makes such a big difference when there are broader, more structural explanations for some of the things that you want to try to understand.
Professor, your explanation is excellent. I mean, concerning, for the example of Second World War, yes, but I think if you really would not endogenize the psychology of someone like Hitler, we cannot really have a picture relatively realistic of what did happen. Certainly the Second World War would happen, but it wouldn't be the same way.
Are you saying that literature isn't there? I mean, there are lots of biographies which presumably do that kind of job.
But I think the international relations can't be exogenous to this type of thinking, especially the contemporary one. Mm. How can we explain the Trump's impact? How can we explain Erdogan's impacts to Turkey?
Definitely the institutions of international society, of world society, whichever one you refer to it. Obviously, these are repositories of practices and ideas and norms. And it just seems that they have a much stronger, let's say, staying power than do individuals. Of course, individuals matter greatly. They give shape to history, but they all have to be contextualized in their own context, in their own context, their own time. So when trying to infer general qualities about international politics or maybe specific civilizations or regional international societies, I guess it makes, I mean, it's difficult, right? It's difficult to incorporate individual psychology into it. But I don't know, everybody else thinks. Are there any other questions for Professor Buzan? Ismail Hocam, you have something to say, please.
If I may, it's a question actually, not a follow-up on the mm-hmm. last point. My question is about, I was wondering whether you could reflect a bit more on or open up what you mean by the divisive politicization offered by the post-colonial readings. Would you mind, telling us a bit more about how you think your work, past work over the past few decades, actually, is different from postcolonial theory's contribution to understanding cultural difference in international relations theory and practice?
I think I can do that. Nobody has ever accused me of being a post-colonialist. I've been accused of being a liberal, and I've been accused of being a realist, and all kinds of other things. But nobody's ever accused me of being a post-colonialist. So I think I'm on safe ground there. The thing that bothers me about post-colonialism is its strong political baggage. I mean, it's not just post-colonial, it's anti-colonial, and it's anti-Western in many respects. And that's both a strength and a weakness. I mean, for a long time, it was a strength. As Amitav and I traced in our 2019 book, where was the voice of the non-West during the formative period of international relations? It was basically an anti-colonial and anti-racist voice, which is perfectly understandable. Those were the issues of the day. And that voice eventually got, as it were, inside international relations in the form of post-colonialism, but it brought with it this very highly charged political baggage. And I see that, I see that in a sense as a real danger, in the sense that, as I've hinted in my talk, I'm of the view that we're currently entering into a period in which the managerial capacity of interstate society is going down quickly. Because there's not only a power transition going on, and it's not the power transition between the US and China, although that's part of it. It's the power transition between, as it were, the first mover core, a small group of Western countries and Japan, and the rest of the world. So the core periphery system with a small core and a big periphery that was set up in the 19th century and ruled for most of the 20th, is now disappearing rather quickly, and something more equal is being put into its place. So my catchphrase for this is, a more diffuse distribution of wealth, power, and cultural and political authority. And so, in a sense, that's what's going on at the moment. And that is a big part of what has weakened the managerial capacity. We've kind of lost the idea of having a hegemonic leader, indeed the whole idea of having a hegemonic leader, not just that we don't want America as a hegemonic leader, but we don't want anybody as a hegemonic leader, seems to be the drift of the times. The counter question to that is, well, how then do we manage our affairs so far badly would be, I think, the only assessment. And one of the reasons that it's badly is because contemporary world politics is poisoned, I think, by the legacy of colonialism. And this has two aspects to it. It has the kind of on the receiving end, I think China and its kind of endless banging on about the century of humiliation is the exemplar of this, that China and a lot of others too go absolutely out of their way, or their governments go out of their way, to keep alive as many of the bad memories of all of that time as they possibly can, and to pump them continuously into contemporary politics, because it works very well domestically to do that. It provides a kind of domestic political support and justification for what governments want to do. On the Western side, on the kind of perpetrator side, if you will, there's a lot of forgetting. Okay? Most people in the West don't think very much about the imperial periods of their country. There's a certain amount of nostalgia even for the grandness of it and the status of it, and a certain feeling that maybe some good was done, as well as that there was certainly quite a lot of bad that was done. But it's all, you know, long ago in the dim distant past, not really our responsibility, other than a bit of development aid and such like. And that situation feeding into one which is anyway problematic about pulling together any kind of global management seems to me to be very, very counterproductive. It's a history problem, if you will, that we all need to address. There's, the Chinese and other governments get away with blaming all of their hard times entirely on the West, or in the Chinese case also on Japan. But you know, China and Japan started from very, very similar points in the middle of the 19th century. The Japanese did okay, thank you very much, and the Chinese didn't, right? So it suggests to me that the Chinese bear some responsibility for their century of humiliation, during which they had a decaying dynastic regime, and then a long, very self-indulgent civil war. If you look closely at that civil war, it's not without significance that both the Chinese Communist Party and the nationalists thought it vastly more important to fight each other than to fight the Japanese. Right? The communists, despite their current declarations on the matter, didn't do much about fighting the Japanese. They let the nationalists, who were very reluctant to fight the Japanese, they let the nationalists do most of that work. Now, this suggests to me that it's just not a one-way street here, that we all went through a very difficult period and there's good and bad on both sides. But at the moment, it's being painted in very black and white terms. I see the legacy of post-colonialism as, in a sense, reinforcing that painting in black and white terms. And that's why I think it not a very useful pathway forward towards more global IR. I take my hat off to post-colonialism. They fought the good fight under difficult circumstances over a long time, and they got that issue onto the agenda. But from my point of view, some of you may differ, you may be more sympathetic to that view. From my point of view, that's not the way forward to a workable global IR, either for the discipline or indeed for practice and the real world.
Oh, thank you, Professor Bouzard. Are there any other questions?
We could call it a day if we're done.
Well, in that case, all right then. Professor Bouzard, thank you very much for your talk. To be honest with you, I've not had a chance to read the book yet. It's on my list. I've ordered it, but hasn't arrived yet, but I look forward to it very much. I've read so much of your previous works as well. In fact, your edited volume on Middle Eastern International Society was somewhat was inspirational for me as well. And I think this was also very productive because, again, this need to have a positive global IR agenda, that's something we've been wanting to develop. That's something that we've been wanting to promote. So this is actually very helpful, very inspirational as well. So thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, also for attending. And thank you for your questions. Hopefully, we can build on some of the ideas here in our research as well. And if you ever want to revisit it, feel free to find us on the YouTube channel, on the YouTube link. You'll be able to enjoy this conversation again. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for hosting me, and thank you for the questions. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.